afternoon and good evening, wherever you all are. And a huge welcome, but actually quite a sad one, as this is actually our last session in our mental health series. And it was a great honor this week to have so many brilliant speakers. We started the week with Emma from Mental Health First Aid England with a presentation on stress, the triggers, the aids and solutions. So I'm so thrilled that we have Simon Blake OBE, who is the CEO of Mental Health First Aid England, joining us today. And he'll be speaking on leading with authenticity and compassion. Really, the aim of this week, though, is just to destigmatize, I don't know if that's a word, but destigmatize mental health, have open conversations, share stories and highlight the wealth of resources that are actually available. We are doing this so that you have an awareness of your own and your friends and colleagues' state of mental health. And let's together help break down the stigma around mental ill health. My name is Miriam Rooney. I am Chief of Staff and Global Client Director for Armstrong Wealth's International CEO Community. Some of you may not be so familiar with us. We are an advisory firm to the Chief Operating Officers within financial services. We aim to empower the CEO community through the provision of thought leadership, share experience, and provide a platform to promote cross-industry dialogue. I've actually only just recently joined Armstrong Wealth, coming from a transformation coaching background, where I worked almost exclusively with C-suite individuals. And I know only too well the impact and life-changing difference it can make when you are, or if you have a leader who is leading with compassion or not. So I'm delighted we are hosting this timely mental health series and highlighting mental health, particularly within financial services. Again today, the webinar is going to run slightly differently as due to the large number of attendance. We would ask if you would send any thoughts or questions into our chat function, and we'll answer as many as possible at the Q&A at the end of the chat. So I'll hand over now to Simon Blake, CEO, Mental Health First Aid England. Simon, welcome. Leading with authenticity and compassion.
Thanks very much, Miriam, and thank you for inviting me, and thank you to all of you who have joined us on Friday lunchtime. This is Mental Health Awareness Week. And for any of you who haven't known about it or it hasn't been raised already, the theme this year is nature and the healing influence of nature. And I guess, in the spirit of authenticity and compassion, just to say, that is something very close to my heart. I grew up in Cornwall. I grew up by the sea. And so, learned very early on that nature has healing powers, mental health, well-being powers that many of us will benefit from on a day-to-day basis. So I'm going to talk to you about leading with authenticity and compassion. So Mental Health First Aid England is a social enterprise. We are based in England as part of a global network of organisations which are delivering mental health first aid and mental health knowledge and awareness skills. We've worked with over 20,000 employers, and the training is really built on a 20-year evidence base. Our mission is to train 1 in 10 of the adult population, and 1 in 10, because exactly as Miriam said, there is stigma about mental health. There is a lack of understanding about mental health, about what we're talking about in relation to mental health. And when, just to be really clear, when I'm talking about mental health, I'm talking about something which we all have, not something which is about mental illness, that is about other people or about our own personal experiences, about all of us. 4 in 4 of us have a brain. 4 in 4 of us will have lived experiences of moving up and down a continuum in relation to mental health and well-being, whether we have a clinical diagnosis or not. But if we are really going to change the dial on mental health, we do have to think about well-being in the workplace. And I think what is really important and what has been so positive about the last year is that employers, us and senior leaders have really tried to think about workplace well-being, about our people's well-being in quite extraordinary times. We've seen people respond with all sorts of creativity, of innovation, of compassion, and that is something which we have to take forward from here. And I'll talk a bit more about that later. But yeah, that 1 in 10 of the adult population, so we can shift the culture. We're not starting with a level playing field here. We're starting from a position where people often feel worried about talking about their mental health at work because they're worried it will impact on how people view them, how they see them, how that might be considered in relation to performance and about their opportunities for the future. And that's clearly something which we want to shift. So leading with authenticity and compassion. Well, firstly, I guess it's probably worth checking out that we know what we mean. So being authentic means being genuine, means being actually and exactly as claimed. Authentic implies being fully trustworthy. And I think if you think about that in the context of work, what does it mean to be trustworthy? It doesn't mean always doing the things which will make you popular. It doesn't mean always doing the thing which is easy, but it does mean doing the things which are perceived to be understood to be trustworthy, even when they're making difficult decisions. And I think that's a really important part of this conversation. How do we deliver with authenticity? And I, just to give you an example of that, I was doing an appeal recently and where there was a throwaway comment made, which is about team morale and well-being. And my response was either to sort of hide my frustration at the idea that I wasn't aware that, of course, this has been an incredibly difficult year, been difficult for everybody right the way through the organisation, or to calmly and kindly explain my perspective on it. And at the end, I, having decided that I was going to explain my perspective on it, I sort of just sat for a moment in silence, wondering whether I'd done the right thing, to which they said, yeah, thank you. And it was a really important moment, actually, and then saying, OK, so now that we recognise that we both understand what's going on, how do we find a way to move forward? Because nobody is thinking that this is an easy moment in time, but we do have to recognise that we've all got a role to play. And then compassion. I was really surprised when I actually looked at the dictionary definition of this today, I have to say. Literally means to suffer together. Among emotions researchers, it's defined as the feeling that arises when you're confronted with another's suffering and feel motivated to relieve that suffering. It's not the same as empathy or altruism, though the concepts are related. And I guess why I was surprised, when you go onto Google now, of course, there are all sorts of different places you can get definitions from. But that idea of suffering together, I guess, was just an interesting word. But for me, that sort of compassion does mean leading from the heart. You know, it does mean understanding and wanting to do what you can to address those issues. And I just thought it's an interesting one to just put as a route for exploration, because we know that people have suffered over the last year. We know that there have been a range of different experiences, and not everybody's been in the same boat, but there has been a universal experience of restriction and some universal experiences of pain as well. So I just wanted to run through a bit of information about the cost of mental ill health. And these figures are all from before the pandemic, and I'll talk to you a bit more about after the pandemic afterwards. So the first is that mental health issues are common. 62% of the UK workforce at some point in their career have experienced the symptoms of poor mental health due to work or where work was a related factor. 30% of the UK workforce have been formally diagnosed with a mental health condition at some point in their lifetime. And that's from Business in the Community Mental Health at Work summary. And then the business cost of mental ill health, £42 to £45 billion per year. Now, for those of you who haven't seen that figure, they are from Deloitte, and they do a regular update that went up between 7 and 9 billion in a 3-year period up till 2019. So from 2016 to 2019. Now, how they costed that was 29 billion in reduced productivity, 6.8 billion in sickness absence, and 8.6 billion in staff turnover. And I just want to hover a moment on the 29 billion in reduced productivity, because I think we often think that it is about people being off work. But actually what the 29 billion is about is people being at work when they should be off work. People not taking their annual leave and still doing work within that time. So presenteeism, leavism, and also that always on culture, which means that because we've got the emails on our phone, that people are not switching off when they should do, which means that they're not getting the rest that they need and that their brain needs in order that they're not being productive further on. And so I think it's really, really critical. If you think about that in the context of what's been happening over the last year, lots of people working from home and lots of people less able to manage the boundary between work and home. So think about the impact of that for productivity. And as we build back, clearly we need to think about what that means. Now, the evidence also shows that for every £1 spent on mental health support, employers stand to receive £5 return. Now, the one thing that I would just say in relation to that mental health support ROI is that what I don't think that accounts for is for when you get a return when you think about job design, when you make sure that people have got the skills and the tools to be able to do their work properly. When you are thinking about, does everybody feel able to contribute in the workplace? So this is about very much about that mental health support. And I just want to sort of flag at this point, you know, given the roles that you do, that the gender pay gap, the ethnicity pay gap, the opportunities for promotion, who sat around the board table, who is the senior leaders, who is seen and is not seen, and who has a place around the tables is as much about mental health and the well-being of workplaces and individuals as the specific mental health interventions. And you know, we've got to think about it in the whole round if we're really going to make workplaces that are diverse, workplaces that are productive, workplaces that have got jobs that are rewarding and that are built on good quality relationships. So MHFA England, we are a training organisation, as I've said, but we also run thought leadership campaigns and development. And one of the ones which we have launched over the last year, actually 3 days after lockdown, sadly, so we had to do a big pivot from a nationwide series of activities that were going to happen in offices to providing some support about working from home. But there is a toolkit, but in that what we've got is a real underpinning this is the insight that not everybody feels able to be their whole self at work, and that when you don't feel able to be your whole self at work, you will often be on protection mode. They'll be holding a part of you back. And so, whether that's about the name of your partner, whether that's about revealing, something about yourself, which you think people will judge you for, whether that's about feeling as though you are heard giving your ideas, or whether somebody else takes the credit for those, which we know often happens for women and people of colour in particular, whether it is about you feel comfortable wearing certain clothes which might be related to your cultural heritage, or speaking your first language on a personal phone call. All of those things, if people don't feel able to bring their whole self to work, are about people then having an element of protection. And when you're looking after yourself, looking out for yourself, you're clearly not giving all of yourself to work. So that sort of concept of being able to take your whole self to work. And sometimes people say, do you mean your whole self? Does that mean you can behave how you want to behave? And no, of course not. You know, we all have professional responsibilities, but we have, if we can not be worried that we'll be caught out, we'll be judged, will people think things about us based on our identity and who we are, then we can really operate on the edge of our brilliance, focusing on work, focusing on the things that we've got to do, rather than worrying about what people are thinking about us. And we know that that's really critical for innovation, for getting on the front foot and for being ahead of the competition. So just to go back to the details here, we'll make sure you get the slides about how you can get the toolkit and all the resources and information here. But during the pandemic, we've seen that there's been significant increases in poor mental health The Centre for Mental Health estimates that over 8.5 million additional, and that should say additional adults, will need mental health support. They actually estimate 10 million additional people, including children under the age of 18, will need mental health support as a result of the pandemic. And that is backed up by all of the tracking data where people have experienced increased anxiety, etc. So we are in an environment where all of those costs that existed before, all of those impacts on work that existed before, and now we need to we factor this into our thinking in terms of our leadership as well. So this is where we start going into the leading with compassion and authenticity. Yeah, one of the key things for us to remember is that workplace stress or stress in the workplace is not always about work. During the pandemic, UK employees may have experienced health anxiety of themselves or of others. They may have experienced significant life moments, for example, the death of a relative. And again, just really important each time we say this to remember that, yes, COVID has been the thing that everybody's talked about, but real life has gone on as well. So, you know, if you think about, so over the last year, myself, my mum got a terminal illness in August and died at the end of December. In amongst that, my dad, who was her primary carer, fell over and broke his femur. None of them are pandemic related, but they happened in the context of a pandemic, which means that there were particular things that we had to do in order to manage that and address that. And there is no doubt that they had an impact on how I was and my performance over the last year, but also some of the things which now have to continue and some of the ways that people may or may not deal with those situations because of a pandemic. People may have experienced trauma during that time. They may have experienced financial well-being, the threat of redundancy of themselves, a partner, people that they live with. Remember that we're all part of our own ecosystems. And if you live with a partner and you relied on joint incomes, you know, what's been happening for other people or even the belief that it might be happening. You know, lots of us have been reorganizing, restructuring, reshaping. And for people that feel the real impact of that, you know, that is stuff which people are feeling in the workplace. Discrimination, lack of access to mental health and wellbeing support. And actually just on the discrimination piece, of course, we know also that over the last year we've seen, you know, really starkly the impact of institutional racism. We've also seen again very, very visibly in national news around sexism, misogyny and violence against women. So all of these things are things which may be have impact for people outside of the work, but will inevitably be felt, experienced within the context of work, because, you know, we don't take our slippers off, put on our work coat and arrive at work. And particularly so when we may have been experiencing these things in our own homes and not been able to have that physical distance. And I don't think we should underestimate the impact of having a physical distance. I know some of my team that have had to do really difficult things say, I had to do it from my kitchen. You know, that has happened in my home. So we need to think about, you know, those experiences for people when we're talking about thinking with compassion, thinking with authenticity and understanding the impact. So wherever we're working, those factors are likely to have had a significant impact on the mental health and well-being of employees. And our understanding now has to be about what does that mean as we continue to look ahead. So clearly awareness needs backing up with action. So 85% of managers feel that employee well-being is the is their responsibility, but 30% have taken part in mental health training. 29% never discuss mental health in their meetings with managers. 16% of employers felt able to disclose a mental health issue to a manager. And normally, I wouldn't talk about diarrhea with people I've never met on a Zoom call, but our research showed that more people would feel more comfortable talking about diarrhea with their manager than they would depression. So, yeah, we're in a situation where we've got to find ways to get better at that. 39% of employees feel more able to bring their whole self to work and be more open with colleagues. 44% say that their workplace well-being offering has not improved in the last year, and 25% say that they've had no well-being check-ins during the pandemic. Now, clearly, if they want, you know, if you want people to believe you care, you know, this is the moment, isn't it? It's the time when having those conversations, talking about care, talking about the trust, how people have, you know, have demonstrated trust and demonstrated that they can do, you know, enormously challenging things in enormously difficult times, you know, is incredibly important. So as we recover from the pandemic, what does it mean to lead with authenticity and compassion? I think the first thing is to show you care, creating that working environment with authentic connections. Now, lots of organisations have been doing town hall type meetings during the pandemic. It feels, no matter how well we've done it, when you're in 2D, it is difficult to create that work environment that then generates authentic connections. And organisations would have tried hard. But as we build back in the recovery, as we think about the future, how will you show you care? How will you try to generate those authentic connections? How will you enable people to see you and other senior leaders trying to work forward, move forward? We can't go back from where we've been. We can't go back to where we were. We've got to go forward to where we want to be. And that will involve having those conversations, demonstrating that we care. That will require being visible, being human, and engaging in open conversation. And I just emphasize being human there, because I think so often when we are in leadership roles, people can feel as though we're not human, particularly when we're making difficult decisions. And of course, difficult decisions, we have to have processes in order for them to be fair, to be equitable, for it to be within the law. But how can we make sure those processes feel human? And yeah, the key thing which I would just urge you to do is think about how can you learn as much about your teams as you can? How can you ensure that they know, you know, life is bigger than COVID-19, that you recognise they're bigger than a cog in the wheel, but that everybody has been affected over this last period? I think there's a real job that we've got to do, and I'm sort of talking, I've talked specifically about rules, policies and procedures, given who you are and the jobs that you do, because I think so often we write policies and procedures to mitigate risk, and of course we've got to mitigate risk. I'm not saying that we don't have to do that, but actually we have to make sure that we build on the trust theme. I think we've asked so much of our teams. We've asked them to do all sorts of things that we just didn't think were possible, and they've demonstrated they can and will and do. So how, moving forward, given that we will have to have new rules, given that we will have to have new policies and procedures, how can you co-create them and have trust at the heart of them? And yeah, we're embarking on this ourselves, and we're a small social enterprise that's fairly nimble, and I know it can feel difficult, because then you say, well, what about this? What about if this happens? But actually, the spirit, the tone, the letters you use, the wording you use, the processes to develop them are really where the authenticity and the compassion comes in and will be felt by your teams. That's the thing, that they have to believe it and they have to feel it. We often talk about well-being support, and again, thinking about identifying unnecessary stressors and to mitigate negative impacts as much as possible. And, you know, of course, we all want work to be rewarding, but we also know that there will be times when we feel the pinch. And, you know, what's the conversations that we've been having, people say, you know, some, on the one hand, you're like, we want to look after your well-being. And on the other, you're saying, and we've got to get everything into virtual learning environments, and we've got to make sure that X happens. And now we've got to go into a recovery year. And all of those things are true. I do care about the well-being. We have got to go into recovery year. We do have to make sure everything is into virtual learning environments. So how can you have those conversations so that if people do have to work really tight to a deadline, and that means long hours, that you then say, OK, and we won't immediately expect that team to go back into, you know, a high intense period, we'll then focus on X, Y, and Z. If you think about our plans from a well-being perspective, not necessarily that you would do less, but you might well manage the sequencing or the processes or the staffing of them, the human resource elements, slightly differently. And where you can't, having those conversations, we thought about it, we're talking to you about it, and actually these are some things we've just got to do. We recognise it's going to be hard, and these are things that we'll try to do to make it as easy as possible. We'll also examine wellbeing disparities, particularly around working from home, and make wellbeing check-ins part and parcel of work life. Now, there's some, when we say wellbeing disparities, you know, for me, I was lucky to be able to work from a light space without any interruption and with a big kitchen table. Yeah, my partner would have preferred me to have been in the shed, but there wasn't scope to be in the shed, but it was comfortable. But actually, for some people, they're doing it off their dressing table or from their bed. And those differences mean that we need to just be engaging with those, trying to make it as possible, as comfortable as possible, as well as we possibly can. And having those detailed check-ins with people as just part of an everyday conversation can help to highlight where there might be some disparities. You know, there's the assumption that many of us might make is that everybody's in a safe home. We know that that isn't true. We know that there are lots of people who experience exploitation, abuse and harm and at home, and that working from home has been more difficult for some people. But how we find out that is through really having those detailed check-ins, making sure that they're implemented throughout the organisation. And one of the things which people say time and time again in relation to mental health is that there is often a board aspiration or a senior leadership aspiration, but there isn't the operational implementation. So by the time it gets to your line manager, that even if there was a commitment to doing the wellbeing check-ins, unless there is that follow-up to make sure that they've happened and that, you know, what does it mean? That interest at the senior level, yeah, what gets measured counts, right? So how do you make sure it runs all the way through the spine of the organisation? But we need to empower line managers with mental health training. That is a really critical part of the jigsaw, not the only part of the jigsaw at all, and there's many, many more parts, but that is a critical one. I've said that already. And then encouraging boundary setting for flexible working. We've got to make sure that people do not believe that we understand them to be on 24/7 just because they're working from home, but also that they take responsibility for creating those boundaries time and again. I was asked once whether I would turn off the email system over the weekend. And you know, we've got incredibly flexible working. And for some people, being able to work over the weekend was the only way that they were able to manage their childcare or their other caring arrangements, including me when my mum was ill. And so actually, this has to be an adult conversation, it has to be a compassionate conversation, it has to be an authentic conversation, but making sure that we're doing all we can to send the right signals that we want flexibility and boundaries, and that people get the help to understand that they have a responsibility within that as well, whether that's ensuring that they haven't got their emails on the phone or packing away at the end of the day or whatever it is. You know, we can help with tips to do it, but we mustn't be in a position where we do it for people. So I just wanted to talk a little bit about flexible working, because I think it's probably something that's really on people's minds at the moment. And, you know, I honestly don't know what the future is going to hold for us. You know, one hand, people really want to get back to the office because that is it's nourishing, it's energizing, it's rewarding. And I think if you haven't seen, there's a New York Times article called Feeling Blur in the Pandemic. It's called Languishing. I'll make sure you've got the title and link in the chat box afterwards. But what that really is showing is that we are not getting, just not getting the energy from those everyday interactions. And so we're just sort of feeling a little bit blur, you know, and sort of they describe it as the middle child of mental health. You're neither up nor down. You're neither the youngest or the oldest. You're just the one in the middle. Apologies for anybody who's a middle child and feels that way. I think it's really important when we understand flexible working that people's attitudes towards what they want will possibly change as they become more confident about public transport, as they emerge into new worlds. But the ability to work flexibly can help employees manage their work-life balance. I've just put work-life in brackets because I think we need to start thinking about balance more. If we've got a balanced life, which work fits into, that's really important, whether that's spending more time with families, managing household and family responsibilities, increased time for rest and sleep, save time and money commuting. Yeah, one of the things which I've heard time and time again from our team is, yeah, actually we have the most disposable income because the commute, if you live in London, is really, really expensive for most people. So it makes sense for people from a time and money perspective as well. It can also promote authentic connections and allow employees to get to know each other. But when it's not supported effectively, teams can feel less connected and motivated and more lonely. You've got to work at promoting those connections. They won't just happen, particularly beyond the immediate teams. What I've heard time and again is my immediate team, see them every day on a stand up, you're once a week or whatever it is, it's the wider connections. And most of us have probably spent most of our working life trying to knock down silos. I think one of our biggest risks around flexible working, if we don't talk about it and don't work actively at it, is that we start silo working again. And we all know that that doesn't benefit anybody. We also know that the risk of burnout has significantly increased. Over half of employees say they find it hard to switch off and set boundaries between their home and work life. And also, I think we need to remember, goes back to the point earlier, we're in the same storm, but not in the same boat. One in four are working from a sofa or from a bedroom, and that makes the experience really different. So thinking about all of those things, I'm conscious of time, but basically, as employers, there's a whole raft of things that we can do, the honest conversations, thinking about job design, co-creating as we move to the future, making sure people have got the confidence to talk about mental health and well-being, but then also recognising that we cannot do everything, that this is bigger than the workplace, but the workplace, we have a real role to make this work. So employing, leading also means ensuring that people know how to go to the employee assistance programme, to NHS services, their local GP, they can access other services, including counselling, and the Every Mind Matters type app. So there's a wide range. And I guess I'll just leave you with really a view. At the end of the day, what everything that we do is about ensuring that people believe that we care about them, that we are trying to support their well-being, that we're trying to support them to have the energy which you need to work well. And lots of that energy used to come from the office during the day, the social activities which would come from office, the interaction with clients. And when those things are not there, or when those things are happening in different ways, the authenticity, the compassion comes from having the conversations to try and understand the impact of those things not being there, and then trying to think about how we can recreate that or encourage others to recreate that with their peers through their line management structures, so that work can be the positive impact that we want it to be on well-being. Because we know that it's not just reducing stress in the workplace. When work is good for our well-being. When we're well, it's good for work. So, the moral, the human, the financial case is really absolutely bound up in all of that. But all of us have to be really, really, really human in this next period. All of us have to use every ounce of our emotional intelligence to work in partnership, to be able to deliver environments that feel as though you can take your whole self to work, and that you're building those sorts of environments where people feel cared for and trusted and therefore want to do their best.
That's brilliant. I mean, there's a lot of actually quite scary statistics through there, Simon.
Sorry, didn't mean to scare you.
Too late. One of the things I just want to go back on was the actual costs. So between 42 and 45 billion per year, and that's pre-COVID.
Yeah.
So at what point does this need to go to become like a strategic priority? Like it needs to be on the boardroom agendas?
I mean, my view is that health should be a boardroom agenda. And I think it is about it's about health, isn't it? Of which we have to think about physical and mental health. Because, you know, we've talked for a long time about people being our best asset. And I think that it's important to recognise it is people are our best asset, and the health of our people is their best asset. You know, and so work which is which is nourishing, work which is rewarding, work which is manageable, you know, is really, really important. Because if you think about a what's the best way to describe it without the visual on the slide? So we at MHFA England talk about a stress container.
Yeah.
And we all have a stress container. And some of us may be able to manage much more than others, but we'll never know the thing which might be the thing which is going to, you know, make it too much. And so, you know, yeah, the everyday sort of stress and strains, but how do you look after yourself as an individual? How does work remove some of those stresses to try and make sure that people are always able to manage? And that's why, you know, we know that always having tight deadlines, always having too much to do, feeling as though you're not recognised by your manager or that there isn't the understanding, or feeling as though you don't have the same opportunities as other people at work. These are all issues, because stress is a major factor in both physical and mental health. Yeah, that when people burn out, it is because of ongoing and enduring stress. We know that stress impacts on the body as well. And you know, I'm not a clinician, so I don't, you know, I don't ever feel confident in you know, giving very specifics around that. But we know that people have psychosomatic issues which are stress related, but also become physically unwell after enduring stress as well. So, you know, for all of those reasons, having it as a strategic issue on the board, looking after the health of our people, feels to me like it's the number one priority.
Yeah, I think it was like a funnel, and then so it was filling up. But it's also recognizing that, you know, what your stress is could be someone's de-stressor. So some people might get stressed at work, some people need it. So it's recognizing what are the bits that are going to tip you over and what are the bits that are going to reduce the load, really.
And the container has a tap at the bottom. And the tap, you know, is about developing healthy ways of being able to manage stress, turning off at the end of the day. We know during the pandemic, people have struggled to turn off at the end of the day. You know, a glass of wine might be a good tap. Six glasses of wine might be a not so good tap, although a good tap on the wine. And we know that people have drunk more in the pandemic, and drink alcohol is a suppressant. So, you know, how we've had more restrictions, so we've had less exercise, we've had less hugs, you know, all the things which are our usual taps, which is why, yeah, that impact of mental health is more significant through the pandemic. And, you know, some people are saying, oh, it's going to be much easier now that the restrictions are being lifted. But of course, for some people, the restrictions being lifted have just created a different angst because of fears around COVID, fears of public transport, feeling as though things have slowed down, which have been beneficial for them, and worried that life is going to spin out of control again. So, yeah, these are the sorts of conversations which I think should be being had at board level, and staff teams should know that they're being had, and they should be feeding into them, and they should get some sense that the organisation and the individuals, you know, the people at the top of those organisations are understanding the impact. People are understanding the toll that's taken, and of course recognising it's been beneficial for some people as well. So managing all of those things, but having those conversations, really important.
Yes, it also comes down to, I imagine, like a question of culture. You know, some companies are going to take this on board so much quicker than others. In some companies, this is going to be a checklist. It's trying to make it, have it regulated in some ways, so it becomes more of a priority.
Yeah, I mean, I think if we, so at MHF England, we have on our business cases and on our, the templates that you fill in when you're, you know, how will this impact on equity and well-being and therefore performance? Because we just, yeah, they are, equity and well-being are prerequisites for performance. And it's how do you create that visibility within the organization? Because, I think that there's a lot which we can build on over the last year. You know, I don't think there are very few organizations who haven't made some progress. So it's how do we keep that going at pace?
Yeah, one of the other statistics that I thought was quite shocking was only 16% of employees felt comfortable actually disclosing a mental health issue with their managers. What can we do about that? I mean, again, it brings out the human side, doesn't it? We need to be more human. We need to be more compassionate and more caring.
I mean, so it's thinking about why do people not want to share, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's the fear of being judged, fear that people will think you're lesser than, fear that it will impact on your prospects at the organisation. 300,000 people a year lose their jobs because of mental illness. So these things are not unfounded. And I think that it's really critical that, you know, there is, you know, lots of organisations have done, you know, senior leaders sharing their own experiences or you know, trying to make sure within their joining literature that they are a organisation that understands about mental health and wellbeing. You know, trained mental health first aiders, mental health champions, to try and change the cultures so that people do feel able to help. And you know, sadly, there are lots and lots of people with poor mental health or with mental health conditions whose work don't support them well enough, and that's often because the workplace doesn't know what to do. So trying to build this into the infrastructure and then communicate. And I think it's, yeah, this is a talent issue as well. Yeah, when you look at the younger population, people coming into the workplace are saying that they want to work for an organisation that walks the talk on mental health because they believe that it's really critical that we do. City Mental Health Alliance, I know Poppy Jaman spoke earlier in the week. They've done some really interesting research which shows, you know, that people, younger generations are going to demand more of us, yeah, around this. But we also know that people who've worked in high pressure environments, you know, often have their own experiences, and sharing those within the workplace can be incredibly powerful.
Yeah. And one of the really interesting things we have because of this, you know, dislocated workforce, one of the conversations we had this week with one of our own COOs from the community, and he was just talking around, we were talking about trying to support and engage and retain those second and third degrees of contact and how critical they are, particularly for new members of staff. You know, somebody's been in employment for a year, they wouldn't have met anyone in their team yet. So it's trying to get those human points and, you know, the coffee, the virtual coffee mornings, and just how critical they are.
Yeah.
To support the human side, I think. Just have a couple of questions here, Simon. First of all, does the organisation offer support outside of the UK?
So that we're part of a global network, and it depends where in the UK, where outside the UK you are. There may be a local provider, but if you were to email me, my email's simon.blake@mhfaengland.org.
We'll send it out on the mail as well.
Great. I can either we can and we can talk to you about it, or there may well be a local provider within them. We can signpost you to them as well.
Wonderful. Another is, any thoughts on how people will respond when encouraged or asked or mandated to come back into the office, maybe even full time, after spending so long working from home? It's a good question.
Well, it is a really, really, really good question. I have a lot of views on it and some data points around it. I mean, all of the evidence we have is that most people will not want to work full time in an office. They may want to do 3 days a week, 4 days a week, 3 days a fortnight, 2 days a week. But the idea of going back to 5 days in the office feels to me as though some people will have to do that. Yeah, work may require them to. But brave and bold employers, I think, will be having a conversation now, which is, what have we learned? When do people need to be in the office? Why do they need to be in the office? How do we make sure that they're there when they need to be? And how can we create that greater flexibility? And yeah, the organizations that are really focused on greater flexibility, because work takes up too much time for most people. Yeah, that is, yeah, remember that we weren't supposed to be working this long. We work longer than our European neighbors, and that's exacerbated in London. Yeah, when I talk to friends who are still in Cornwall and colleagues outside, the length of the day, yeah, just shocks people. And an hour and 20 minutes of that each way is a commute for a lot of people. So, yeah, how do you, why, I guess, so that's the first question. Why would people, and when would people need to be back full time? Secondly, how can you be as flexible as possible? Because there is a whole range of demands. We've just done our survey. Some people got the other ends of the spectrum where I never want to come in unless I really have to. I want to be in every day. Very few people on either end of the spectrum. Most people are like, 1 or 2 days, 3 or 4 days, please. Can we do X, Y, and Z? But the thing which people are really nervous about is about public transport. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that London has had a big enough conversation about public transport yet and what that means, about the cycling infrastructures, about our walking infrastructures, about the flexibility that we may give people. So, I mean, I'm not a risk-averse person. I'm also not in a high-risk category. But I don't think I'll ever get on the tube at Clapham Common again. it's too tight. It's too close. I don't want to be in those sorts of environments. And lots of people are nervous about that. And we need to recognise, so between 7 and 8:45, Clapham Common tube station is an absolute nightmare at the best of times, even to be able to squeeze on. Get to 9:15, 9:15, it's a completely different affair. So what does that mean for working hours, core hours, all those sorts of things? And I guess from my perspective, the conversation about public transport and understanding how people get to the office is as important as what happens in the office and at home as well. And I'd really, I probably shouldn't put that in my slides, because that's the single biggest thing which keeps on coming up in terms of conversations that are happening in London, and people feeling as though one of the things that's causing them greatest concern is not acknowledged by their employers when they're having conversations about return to the office.
Yeah, and that will also include, the vaccination issue as well. Those people who are vaccinated or who are in the office, they don't want to sit beside someone who hasn't been given the vaccination.
So that the people who are not vaccinated don't want to feel judged either if they don't want it or haven't been able to have it yet. So there's all sorts of dynamics which just go on with this. And we've had conversations about, lateral flow tests, and should it be mandatory or is it just, encourage people to do it? And ultimately it's about our individual responsibility to ourselves and each other, isn't it? And how do you embed that sense of responsibility? And how do you have the freedoms and flexibilities which mean that people can manage their emotional responses, their well-being and their performance, in the context of everything that's going on as well. I've got some staff who've had children sent home from school 3 days after suddenly something's happened in the bubble and the child's sent home from school, and the best laid plans suddenly all out of the window. So what does that mean for the number of reports, the hours, the meetings, all of those sorts of things? It's just an ongoing conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I just think it's going to introduce a huge degree of flexibility that we're just probably not quite used to. We normally had our regular working hours. I think all of that's going to have to change, really, and just have a flexibility on all parts of that.
It is. And I think, I left my house for a meeting for the first time last week, and remembered what it was like to get a buzz cycling through central London and then seeing a real person, and all of those things. But the other bit was it reminded me how much time we used to spend traveling around during the day as well. And is how do we balance the benefits and payoffs versus the fact that actually you know, if you have real clarity about the purpose of meetings, you can probably get more done in a day without less travel time, all of those sorts of things. You know, and so we've gone, haven't we, from little flexibility to almost complete flexibility. And now there's a bit which is, how do we be as flexible as we can be, recognizing those impacts of, you know, being sedentary, being in the same place all the time without seeing people in teams. How do we get the best of it all is probably the exam question. How do we get the best of it all for all of our staff? And how do we make everybody feel like they're the CEO of their own job? Yeah, that feels to me as though that's the question, because we, or COO or whatever, we all have enormous privilege in leadership positions around flexibility and always have had, more so than others. So how do you, and have often, you know, delivered, over-delivered, you know, done what we need to, how do we make everybody feel like the CEO of their own job?
Absolutely, and respected in the same time. Yeah, it's going to, I think it's got, we'll find out more over the next another 12 months, and I think we're going to be in a very different place, just keeping a track of everything that's going on. One of the things I just want to bring up for, because we're almost up to the hour, is just go back to the 16% who only were the ones who felt able to disclose. In terms of training, what were the first steps in introduced training to the managers around mental health?
So there's different ways of doing it. I think, you know, in an ideal world, all staff members would have some awareness training around mental health. It would help them for themselves and for others. You would then have some training which was specifically about the line management relationship and how line managers can spot signs, can understand, can have good quality conversations. And then we would also, Mental Health First Aid England, be saying, you know, an organisation can also have mental health first aids. Not everybody at this time, for the stigma reasons that we talked about earlier in relation to stigma, not everybody wants to talk to their manager. Not everybody feels confident talking to their manager. So by having mental health first aiders, they are designated people who are also able to be contacted. They're advertised, you know, on the internet. They might, if you're in real life sectors, have a lanyard or posters on the walls, etc. And they can be a first line of support for people. And a combination of those things, you know, is really helps to create the culture and then to create the specific skills which you need line managers to have. You know, we train all of our staff, everybody that arrives, we train in mental health first aid. So you have a culture where people have the skills to be able to have the high quality conversation. And then managers are expected to ask the same question at the beginning of all mental health, all one-to-ones, which is, how are you and what are you doing to look after yourself? And the reason that we do that is once you have been managing somebody for a while, you'll spot patterns, you'll mm-hmm. see things. For me, if you were managing me, if I said, I haven't been out very much and I haven't been doing any exercise, the immediate question would be, that isn't your usual way. Is there anything that I need to be worried about? And so you're not diagnosing, you're not doing anything other than saying, oh, feels like some things have changed here. Is there anything that we need to worry about? Which gives permission for people to open up, people to feel as though you walk alongside them. So there's some tips. And of course, people are nervous about talking about mental health in the way that they're not in talking about physical health. And that's what we've got to overcome. Mm. You know, people feeling as though they can have a conversation. It's at the heart. Yeah, our mental health, our well-being is the heart of our humanity. And therefore, having conversations is just a natural, normal part of our everyday, you know, experience. It can't be a one-off. Has to be something, but it is a skill that we develop.
Mm. We were actually talking yesterday about the branding around mental health. You know, you think of physical health, we're talking about, you know, you'll see somebody who's super athletic and chiseled. And in mental health, you see someone with their head in their hands. So, I mean, and, you know, even that on its own needs to change.
Yeah. 100%. I mean, most of us, I was laughing actually with somebody recently. I said, you know, I'm fast approaching 50. In my 20s, I did physical exercise to try and get a body that I've never been able to get. But actually, that physical exercise has been really good for my brain. And my brain has then helped look after a body, which has never let me down. It's just never been, you know, like the front page of Men's Health or even Take a Break or whatever it is. You know, it just was never going to be like that for most of us. And you know, the danger of the head in your hands bit is that that hides the reality. You know, that for so often it is, you know, people carry on functioning. They don't put their heads in their hands, but they're not functioning in the way that they could be able to. They're not thriving. So yeah, huge long way to go. But I guess thinking about our body and mind as a onesie, you know, Ruby Wax describes it as a onesie. You know, what's going on in our body impacts on our mind. What goes on in our mind impacts on our body. So think of them as one and the same. You know, what we eat impacts our body. What we drink, how we sleep. Yeah, you know, all of these things, which, you know, in danger of being, you know, what people often describe as, you know, nanny state about it. But, you know, drinking a decent amount of water, moving, digital detox, getting sleep, whatever our mental, you know, our mental, whether we have a clinical diagnosis or not, will be good for us. Yeah, you know, those things are universally good for our body and our mind. And anybody who's been awake all night with a baby or with the animals or whatever will know that when you're tired, things are more stressful. You know, all of those things which we know, it's just becoming, and I'll just go back if I can to this slide, which is the wellbeing check-in. So this My Whole Self MOT, one of the things that I've learned a lot when I came to Mental Health First Aid England, which was only 2.5 years ago, and I wasn't, you know, this wasn't my profession before, was how by becoming aware of our mental health, by becoming aware of our well-being, how we're thinking, our stress container, we can actually be much better. You know, we're much better at looking after ourselves, at managing those things. And so this is about becoming conscious about our well-being, about our mental health in ways that we often are. If we've got a sore knee, some of us might ignore it, but we'd also think about, oh, I've got a sore knee, I best rest up, or I won't go running today. Yeah. We've got to become acutely aware of that in the context of our mental health and well-being too.
Absolutely, and the whole self MOT is exactly what we need to remember. We're just coming up to the hour, so I just want to say a huge thank you, Simon. We are beyond grateful for your time today. And I also want to thank every one of you for attending today and for attending the sessions earlier in the week. I have loved moderating these sessions. It has been an absolute privilege. I've loved every second of it. So really, I just want to hope that this week has reinvigorated you all. Please remember, you cannot outsource your mental health. Remember to put your own oxygen mask on first to be in a better position to help others. You have a purpose. Find it and remember it. Draw boundaries. Show compassion. Keep strong connections. Belong. Have hope. And in an industry where it seems sometimes it's all about revenue and it's all about competencies and skills, love, and love even harder. Be you, authentically you, and share your story. Huge thank you again, Simon. And let's hope, as I'm sure it will, it'll inspire our leaders and our future leaders. And thank you, Charlotte, in the background, who runs and puts all this together for me. So please contact us if you have any information or any queries. And we will also send on Simon's links to his email and website. So have a wonderful rest of day and a truly purposeful and compassionate future. Thank you all so very, very much. Bye.